from occurring than to restore people after it's happened. As Jack Barkas, chairman of the Department of Psychiatry at Cornell, points out, the longer you can keep someone functioning, the more solid psychic history he has to fall back on. So even delaying the onset of schizophrenia would have value. Experts have devised a menu of symptoms that indicate the prodromal stage. Suspiciousness, unusual, magical, or bizarre thinking, extreme changes in behavior patterns, decreased functioning, inability to go to school or function at a job. Confusingly, many of these are also symptoms of ordinary adolescence. In studies that have followed subjects identified as prodromal, only a third have actually developed schizophrenia, though many others will develop serious disturbances. Starting in 2003, McGlashan tried giving the antipsychotic olanzapine, Zyprexa, to apparently prodromal people, and showed that the rate of developing schizophrenia was somewhat reduced. It also made many people who might not have gone on to develop the syndrome obese, sluggish, and glassy-eyed. The positive result was only marginally significant, and the negative result was clear, he said. It's difficult to figure out what to do with these mathematics, because while powerful medications may block the onset of psychosis, those medications have too many undesirable effects to be used on people who may just be presently grumpy, and we cannot now tell the difference. Studies in England and Australia show that cognitive behavioral and other non-biological therapies can diminish or delay the onset of symptoms. Antioxidants and other neuroprotectants, such as omega-3 fatty acids, may delay the onset of psychosis without side effects. It doesn't seem to matter what the intervention is, McGlashan said. The psychocognitive behavioral intervention was just as good as medication. If you can keep them engaged and relating and challenging their symptomatic experiences, you can delay this crescendo into an acute psychotic episode. It could be that you are helping to prevent loss of learned connections in the brain. The families of people at high risk for developing schizophrenia should learn what to watch for, and doctors should meet frequently with patients, since they can escalate to psychosis in a few days. While antipsychotics are not recommended until psychosis sets in, aggressive response to anxiety and depression is in order. A strong movement to categorize the prodromal phase as its own illness in the DSM-5, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual that is psychiatry's Bible, as psychosis risk syndrome, or attenuated psychosis syndrome, was abandoned in the spring of 2012. The diagnosis would have given doctors protections and compensation for treating patients aggressively. But because the degree of psychosis risk in any individual is so difficult to quantify, the framers of the new DSM eventually determined that there was too much potential for unnecessary, stigmatizing, and harmful treatment. It makes sense that someone at risk for developing schizophrenia be treated with benign interventions and close monitoring. But the issue of stigma cannot be ignored as it pertains to both self-image and medical insurance. McGlashan wrote, "The bottom line for me is that the psychosis risk syndrome should be treated as a bona fide psychiatric disorder. It is real, and it can be very dangerous if ignored." John Crystal, however, pointed out, "The earlier you are in any mental disease process, the less you know what you're dealing with. Earlier intervention is almost always preferable and harder, sometimes so hard that it's not preferable. What they do in the DSM is a fashion question, like skirt lengths. But we have a dichotomous medical system. Good clinicians will lie about their patients' symptoms to get them insurance coverage and treatment if they seem to be sick, while poor ones will punish patients on this checklist basis." Even with early identification, it can be a challenge to sustain treatment over the lifespan. Lieberman tells of a patient he treated early in his career. He was 21 years old, Ivy League school, top of his class, popular, athlete, seemed to be destined for greatness. He developed psychotic symptoms, and I diagnosed schizophrenia and gave him medication. He had almost complete remission. Then he wanted to go back to school, and he didn't like the medication, so he stopped taking it. He became sick again, came back, we treated him, he improved, went back to school, and relapsed again. We treated him, and he made progress. Repeated again. The next time, he didn't get better. He never recovered. George Clark is a physicist at MIT who works on theoretical astrophysics. He is both kind and almost entirely occupied by intellect. His wife, Charlotte, is capable of toughness after a tough existence, at once judgmental and sympathetic, as though it were her habit to find weakness everywhere around her and then forgive it. She has bright blue eyes behind wire-rimmed spectacles, snow-white hair neatly kept, and capable hands that she uses for punctuation when she speaks. They were both in their 80s when we met, and I saw with what gratitude George handed difficulty over to Charlotte. When George and Charlotte married in 1980, each had a problematic daughter. George had Jackie, then 19, diagnosed with schizophrenia 4 years earlier. Charlotte's daughter, Electa, the same age as Jackie, was disjointed and bewildering, but would not receive a diagnosis for another 18 years. Charlotte told me that George had had a harder time than she, because Jackie had once been so promising, whereas Electa had been odd all along. "I knew the day I gave birth that she was different," Charlotte said. "She was limp, like a bag of sugar." Charlotte tried to be the same mother to this child that she had been to her other children, but the connection was effortful. She was oblivious. Other children were afraid of her. They saw that something was strange there. The family was living in Pakistan because Electa's father was working for USAID. The older children thrived at the international schools, but at 5, Electa couldn't follow what was going on. A year later, her father was transferred to Jordan. She went to the American school in Amman, had a remedial tutor, and was coached by Charlotte. "By 8, she could read," Charlotte said, "but she wasn't interested. In fact, she wasn't interested in anything." When Electa was 9, her father died suddenly of a heart attack, and Charlotte moved the family to Washington, D.C. Electa was bullied in the local 4th grade. Charlotte put her in a special school, which helped briefly. By 14, she was out of control. She was fucking, if you'll excuse the expression, anybody who would, and she was flunking out, her mother recalled. "So I sent her to boarding school. She was very unhappy there. I said, 'I was unhappy when you were here. You have to graduate from high school.' So she earned her GED. Then she said she would be a hairdresser. I thought, 'Hairdresser?' But she loved it and did well at it. Those were her best days. But slowly, slowly, she was going crazy." One bright October morning, Charlotte called Electa, then 37, and Electa said, "I can't talk on the phone." Charlotte said, "Come over and have a cup of coffee." When Electa arrived, she said, "I can't talk in the house." So Charlotte said, "Let's go for a walk." Electa explained that she couldn't talk on the pavement either. She could talk only if they walked in the middle of the road. So they dodged cars while Electa explained that the mafia at MIT was after George, and that he might be part of it. A few months later, Charlotte received a call. One of Electa's friends had found her at the gym, curled up in the fetal position, crying. The friend took her to the emergency room, where the doctors tried to do an EKG. Electa began screaming and thrashing and ended up in the psychiatric ward, where she finally received a schizophrenia diagnosis. She was also an alcoholic. Over the following years, Electa's psychosis was contained by medication, but she suffered endless side effects. Her weight ballooned to over 300 pounds. "She can hardly walk," Charlotte said. "She used to be the beauty of the family." Her enunciation was slowed, and she slept long hours. She met another schizophrenic, Tammy, who became her romantic partner. Then after 10 years on clozapine, Electa's condition began to deteriorate in early 2006. "I remember saying to her, 'You're not taking your meds, are you?'" Charlotte recalled. She said, "I don't need my meds," in a very aggressive tone. By October, she wouldn't answer the door, and her phone was disconnected. Neither Tammy nor Charlotte could find out what was going on. "She had a credit card on my account," Charlotte said, "and I yearned for the bill so that I could see where she had been and know that she was still alive. But when the bill hit $10,000, I had to cancel it." Charlotte finally convinced a judge to authorize the police to break in. The sink was stopped up, and there was food all over the place, and it was crawling with maggots. "I had to go back to court twice to have her committed, and when she went to the hospital, they couldn't even get her into a shower. Two nurses had to hold her down when they were washing her." But gradually, the medication took hold. She began washing herself, and then she began being happy to see us. Electa, now 50, hasn't worked since the breakdown. "She still can cut hair, but not as well as she used to," Charlotte said. "I encourage her to cut my hair once in a while, and she cuts Tammy's. It keeps some part of her alive." Charlotte and George were childhood friends long out of touch. When Charlotte was widowed and George was divorced, they were reintroduced. They deliberately bought a house that didn't have enough space for Jackie and Electa to live with them. Jackie had been beautiful, highly energetic, and popular, Charlotte said. She showed early signs of her father's intellect. She was a brilliant flautist and a champion chess player. When Jackie was 15, the math that had come so easily to her a year earlier was suddenly incomprehensible, and George found that he could not explain to her the simple equations that she could once have explained to him. George went to see the chief therapist at MIT, who said that Jackie was schizophrenic. Jackie's mother walked out on them both, leaving a marriage that was already in disarray. When Charlotte and George got together, Jackie was 19 and had just been evicted from a group home. "This was when I was deciding whether I wanted to live with George myself," Charlotte said. "I decided I was up for it." Jackie was supposedly taking Thorazine. She was actually flushing it down the toilet. "Over dinner, the first night after I moved in, Jackie took a plate and threw it across the room. Nobody's ever done that, before or since, at my table." Charlotte began to lay down ground rules. Shortly after Jackie turned 20, Charlotte told her to make her bed, and she blew up. George heard her shouting and came downstairs. "He's very strong," Charlotte said. "So is she." He took her by both wrists. She was spitting in his face. He kept holding her. Finally, she said, "Dad, I don't know what's wrong." A few months later, Jackie hitchhiked from Massachusetts to New York to surprise her estranged mother. When her mother asked how the trip was, she said she was only raped 5 times. Charlotte said, "Of course, you never know what to believe. You don't know what happened, and neither does she." In the years that followed, Jackie was in and out of mental hospitals, group homes, and other protective arrangements that varied with the fluctuations of her psychosis. Eventually, clozapine came along. "She's very sweet now that she's medicated," Charlotte said. By the time I met Jackie, she was 49 and had been on clozapine for 15 years, and she was living in a group home with 7 other women. She spent her days at a day program that she referred to as the club. If her caseworker deemed it necessary, she was hospitalized for a few days or weeks. Unlike most schizophrenics, Jackie did not become obese on antipsychotic medications. She plays tennis, swims a mile every day, and does yoga. She is antithetical to Electa's melancholy sluggishness. Every Saturday, Charlotte and George have Jackie and Electa over. Electa often brings Tammy. Jackie sometimes brings one of the other women from the club or the group home. "Thankfully, Jackie and Electa like each other as much as schizophrenics ever like anybody," Charlotte said. "I don't want to say I don't want to be their mother anymore, but there comes a point when you're 81 and should not have to be taking care of your children as if they were 5-year-old tiddlywinkies. I'm not even convinced it's making them happy." Electa remembers how it was to be well, which gets in the way of her being happy. Jackie is too out of it to be happy. I went to one of Charlotte's lunches. Jackie was instantly engaged, intense and full of questions, while Electa was a manatee, vast, slow-moving, benign. Jackie substituted words for no particular reason, calling her car "my visa," for example. She began lunch by reciting Rilke at a breakneck pace and without expression. But when Charlotte asked her to repeat the poems more clearly, she said, "I can't. It's too painful." She told me proudly how she memorized poetry in the bathtub. "I recite to myself in cold water." She talked persuasively about the importance of physical exercise in the treatment of mental illness, then added, "When I play tennis with my sister, I can tell when she's cheating. She has this way of planning for the future. That's cheating." Then things lapsed into true chaos. When I asked Jackie about her medications, she explained that she couldn't take birth control pills because she didn't want to have varicose veins. "But I don't think any man except my dad's spirit could make me pregnant," she said. "It says so in the Bible that he wrote. I feel responsible, just like Jesus Christ felt responsible when he handed out 2,000 cigarettes. They weren't pans of bread. They were cigarettes, in my opinion. That's why she keeps killing my daughters that I had with my dad's spirit. One of them is 10 years older than me for some reason. The other one I gave $1.25 for a soda. I much prefer to have babies off women. Most people don't admit that they're gay, and they are. They're all gay, in my opinion." Then she looked at me closely and suddenly said, "Would you like some more cucumbers?" and offered me the dish. I took some more cucumbers. "I really like my day program," she said, "and I have a real connection to poetry, too. I love making art. It's a real pleasure in my life these days." As seamlessly as we had crossed into psychosis, we were back on solid ground. Jackie was clearly unaware of the shift. Charlotte later said, "It comes and goes. It doesn't seem to be much harm to anyone, including her, though it takes some getting used to." Electa has few intrusive delusions. "If what Jackie has is schizophrenia," Charlotte said, "I am inclined to think Electa is being medicated for an illness she doesn't have." But of course she does, really. It's just such a diffuse condition. Electa's negative symptoms are far more pronounced. "I just feel lethargic," she said. "I have to really psych myself up for grocery shopping. I can only do it once a month. so I eat a lot of stale things. When I asked Electa about the time when she had gone off her meds and been so ill, tears welled up in her eyes. I wanted to feel high again, she said. I'll help you, Jackie interrupted. Wait here, she ordered, and ran off to find copies of her own recent poems. One of them was nearly gibberish, but the other contained these lines. And when I tried to find the lover to show her how much I loved her, all I found was emptiness and frenzy, with that loud sound in the background drowning out my voice every 4 seconds. The loud sound is the intrusive voices, rising relentlessly and constantly over any attempt at a rational mind. And a rational mind wrote this poem, which seems startlingly full of self-knowledge for the work of someone who believed she had conceived 400 babies with her father. I thought of the Erinyes in pursuit of Orestes, the senseless anguish of a ceaseless externalized torture. I said to Charlotte, "You do have your hands full." "Sometimes life isn't about choices," she replied. When a patient's resolve to continue with the detested medication fails, family members are often the first to notice and intervene, despite the obstacles the patient may devise. The parent's affection always aspires to reawaken a comparable emotion in its object. Like those who have autism, people with schizophrenia are often described as incapable of emotional attachment, but this is seldom true. The blunted affect or emotional vacancy that's become a stereotype of schizophrenia is not blunted all the time, and in many cases is not blunted most of the time, Deborah Levy said. Schizophrenia experts Larry Davidson and David Stainer write, "While perhaps appearing as wooden and vacant to others, and perhaps also feeling at an extreme emotional distance even from themselves, people with schizophrenia continue to describe a fervent wish for love and relationships that contrasts starkly with the empty shell image." Parents would do well to know that to most schizophrenics, a penumbra of affection is reassuring, even if it does not seem to penetrate their isolation. Patients who have a trusting relationship with someone, a parent, a friend, a doctor, are more likely to take their medication. "About 40 to 50% of my patients are non-compliant," said Jean Fraser, who works primarily with younger patients at McLean. "Sometimes they will come to me and say, 'Dr. Fraser, I'm feeling better, and I want to stop my medication.' It becomes very clear with some that if I don't join them in their wish, they are going to do it anyway. So I say, 'I don't think it's the wisest thing to do, because you will run the risk of recurrence. But maybe at this point in your treatment, it's important to find out for sure.' Then we come up with a plan to taper their medication by about 30% every week. I'll say, 'I want to support you in what you feel needs to happen, but you have to promise that you and or your parents will page me immediately if you start hallucinating. You need to agree that if that happens, you're going right back on your medication.' I tell the families about the potential for suicidal ideation. Almost all of them have recurrence of symptoms and realize that they really need the medication. It's a learning process. If you really are decompensated, you lose all self-knowledge. But when you are beginning to decompensate, you know that there's something wrong. They become scared. Then, hopefully, they will tell me." The mother of one schizophrenic told me that her son's therapist had him write out a motto and post it on his refrigerator. It says, "I am a good person, and other people think I'm good too," and it has had an enormous effect on him, she said. George Markelow had a lot of friends in high school in New Jersey. He had been a pothead in his teens, and in his senior year, he took LSD. A few weeks later, he decided to try it again, but instead of taking one tab, he took four. After that, things sort of felt weird, he recalled. I think the acid sped up the progress of the disease, which I guess was already in me. In college, George was a brilliant physicist. He is the smartest person in our family, his father Giuseppe said. George remembered, November 1st, 1991, when I was at Boston College, I woke up and I felt like I was on acid. I had not taken anything or done anything. That didn't go away for 8 years. George went to a doctor on campus who said that it would pass. At the time, George accepted that. Now he is outraged. If I heard somebody say, I feel like I'm on drugs, but I'm not on drugs, I'd be like, we'd better get you checked out. He was loath to tell his parents or friends what was going on. I was afraid they'd think I was insane. I substituted alcohol and pot for medicine. Everything was amplified. Food tasted really bad. If I had taken meds back then, I could have avoided 8 years of that. Despite his symptoms, he kept up a 3.7 average in physics. But it is progressive, George said. The voices became more and more prominent. He took a job with a dot-com startup on Wall Street. After a few months, he stopped going to work, and nothing his parents could say or do would get him to go back. George's parents had divorced when he was in high school, and he was living with his mother, Bridget. She explained to me, young men get out of college, and somebody has to kickstart them because they don't realize that they are supposed to make a life. I thought he was in an extreme form of that. I was concerned, sometimes exasperated, but I didn't see the real problem. Things grew stranger. He said he knew what the neighbors were thinking about down the street, Giuseppe recalled. Bridget was bemused. Still, I didn't think there was psychosis, she said. The Markelos insisted that George see a therapist, and after about 4 months he shared that he had been hearing voices. I was so frightened that I didn't even think of the word schizophrenia, Bridget said. It took some months for the Markelos to find their way to David Nathan, a Princeton psychiatrist who has worked with people with thought disorders. He instantly recognized the severity of George's illness and put him on medication. George has not had a job since that post-college stint on Wall Street. George used to hide pills in the side of his mouth and spit them out when his parents weren't looking. During a relapse, he crashed his car 3 times. He finally became medication compliant after a decade. His voices are persistent, but somewhat banal. Sometimes they say critical things, but I can ignore that, he said. Some voices are jerks, you know? You end up having the same conversation sometimes with a new voice that doesn't know what you told the old voices. At first, I thought the voices were people around me. Then I realized that they didn't even do what they said they were going to do. So now, I hear them, I talk to them, but I don't believe they're going to do anything. While I'm talking to you, I can ignore them. The medication has never made them go away, but it makes it easier for me to deal with them. There's some I like to talk to, and some that I can't stand. Even though I hate the whole thing, there are some voices I would definitely miss if they went away. George moved in some years ago with Giuseppe, who has focused his life almost entirely around his youngest son. I wouldn't date, because I can't afford other distractions, Giuseppe said. I have to do what I have to do for George. George's older brother has indicated that he will take care of George when Giuseppe is gone. George, 35 when we met, was on clozapine and had regular blood tests. I'm better than I used to be, he said. I still get a little paranoid when I'm in public, but I can function. My parents have been very vigilant on my medicines, and they pay good attention to my behavior. I don't do too much. I basically talk to the voices all day long. If Dad's home and I'm going to talk to them, I go in another room. I don't like it when people see me talking to myself. Even my father. Giuseppe has found ways to deal with the voices. He said, George is laughing with them, and I say, George, cut me in. Let me know what everyone's saying. And we joke a bit about it. Bridget said, it doesn't seem like a very high-level conversation. Like guys standing on a street corner. It upsets me to hear it. But I take a deep breath, and I never tell him to stop. George sees Dr. Nathan every week, and Giuseppe usually goes along and sits through the session. George likes the arrangement, which saves him the trouble of explaining everything twice, to his father and to his doctor. There's not much I can do other than take the meds, see the doctor, George said. Just hope that the bad events keep to a minimum. My situation is obviously stressful for both of my parents, and I know it's not my fault, but I feel bad about it. Giuseppe said, I don't care what it's done to me, but I sit in my room and cry because of what he's missing, what life ought to be about, could be about, and isn't about for him. Bridget said, he's such a wonderful person, decent, kind, gentle. He deserves so much better. At the beginning, I thought, he'll never have a normal life. You just think, what is a normal life? Who has a normal life? What are any of us doing here? I'm so proud of my three sons for what they've accomplished. My oldest son, he's so talented and determined. My youngest son, he's so good at what he does. But George is so decent. Look at all he does with this going on in his head. I might be proudest of him. Emerging with the early intervention movement is the recovery movement, which proposes biological treatment to address positive symptoms and psychosocial methods to ameliorate negative and cognitive symptoms. The focus is on improving the quality of life even for those whose clinical condition is poor, emphasizing that impaired people still have capacities that should be maximized. Case management makes certain that even patients who suffer continued psychotic symptoms, erosion of cognitive ability, and social limitations have somebody to handle their health insurance, take them to doctor's appointments, ensure that they have a place to live. Patients are helped in finding a workplace where their deficits are tolerated and supported. Some are given rehabilitation training to develop job skills. Social skills training teaches them how to interact with others in more acceptable ways. Patients do computer-based brain exercises that enhance memory, decision-making, and attention. Any way that people can be knitted into the social fabric is precious. One mother whose son had recently been diagnosed described pulling into a gas station and looking at the teenager working the pump. 2 years ago, I would have thought he was living a sad, wasted, pointless life, she said. Now I thought, oh, if only my son could be like him. Marnie Callahan's sister Nora has long been in constant conversation with Eric Clapton. Nora lived with Marnie for some time, but then one day Marnie came out of her room, 8 months pregnant, and found Nora, then 24, standing at the door with scissors in her hands. I said, what are you doing here? Marnie recalled. She said, I have no idea why I'm here. Who are you? I picked up the phone, 7 o'clock in the morning, and I said, Mom, Dad, I'm bringing her home right now. In the years that followed, Nora lived with her mother and went on and off her medications until they were no longer fully effective. Finally, my mother had a stroke, Marnie said. I can't say Nora caused the stroke, because my mother had borderline high blood pressure, but it didn't help. Nora pushed my mother down and broke her shoulder. So I went to the state of Maine and applied for guardianship. I talk to Nora or do some Nora-related thing at least 4 or 5 times a day. At 53, Nora is now in assisted housing, but keeps her sister abreast of her exchanges with Eric Clapton. Yet much of who Nora was survives within this troubled and troubling self. She sees people so clearly, Marnie said. It's almost as if, in our social order, we've learned to mask and hide. Schizophrenics cut right through that. For all of her contentiousness and discordant behavior, she's just trying to get by, like all of us. I can't abandon her. I'll visit her in her simple little apartment, and even with all this pain, she still has that fight in her. She still tries to have dignity in every day. A little flower arrangement over here, something pretty there, that little touch of something creative. It doesn't die. Jeffrey Lieberman at Columbia University evinced considerable frustration around how little use is made of the tools we have. The problem is that people become mental patients in their chronic wasteland, stuck away someplace in their rooms, smoking cigarettes, doing nothing, going to see a doctor for a prescription once a month, he said. We now have medical and social means to help people. But because of limitations in resources, lack of awareness, and stigma, most people aren't helped. Only a small percentage of people with schizophrenia are refractory, unresponsive to medical treatment, and need permanent hospitalization, he explained. The rest could be managed with acute care hospitals and adequate community services. We have people in the hospital whose families don't want or can't take them back, and they can't live independently, and we can't find them a supervised residence. You discharge them to a homeless shelter. In the United States, 150,000 people with schizophrenia are homeless. 1 in 5 people with schizophrenia is homeless in any given year. Such people are soon off their meds and back at the hospital for acute care. This serves neither their medical advantage nor the state's economic interest. The 2008 National Survey on Drug Use and Health reports that cost is the primary barrier to care for serious mental illness. Less than half of schizophrenics in the United States receive outpatient services, a little more than half receive prescription medication, and half of those who go untreated blame cost and insurance issues. When I asked Jean Frazier whether it had been emotionally draining to work with schizophrenic patients, she said, "The thing that makes me emotionally drained is managed care. When I have to fill out yet one more form just to increase the dose of an antipsychotic that's already approved, it really impacts the quality of service I can provide." Treating schizophrenia in the United States costs more than $80 billion a year, expenses that could be controlled with programs of active outreach to patients, most of whom, with supports to stay in appropriate treatment, could avoid both descents into raving hell and the ensuing expensive hospitalizations and incarcerations, largely underwritten by taxpayers. As things work now, it falls to families to organize support groups, construct community centers, create websites, and write memoirs full of advice. A family member can commit a schizophrenic to institutional care only if he poses an acute danger to himself or someone else, and the burden of proof is difficult, even though at least 1 in 5 schizophrenics will attempt suicide. A schizophrenic man jailed for a misdemeanor after quitting his medication was seen eating feces from the toilet bowl in his cell. On grounds that a person would not die from eating human waste, and that the man was therefore not a danger to himself, the judge refused to commit him. Kenneth Duckworth, a former medical director for the Massachusetts Department of Mental Health, said, "It's harder to get into a state hospital than into Harvard Medical School. families are routinely obliged to lie about their relative symptoms to obtain services. Half to two-thirds of people with schizophrenia live with their families or have parents as primary caretakers. But according to a recent survey, only about 3% of those families deem it an appropriate arrangement. The problem is that people burn out, especially because a family member with schizophrenia may not appear to appreciate the enormous amount you do for them, Lieberman explained. The family must be a treatment center, an outpatient unit, a constellation of eyes to watch over, a series of hands to cook or clean or soothe or restrain. In short, an interlocking and yet ceaselessly shifting system of organizations for the patient's discipline or haven. Family members frequently give up or compromise careers to do this work, resulting in economic hardship, and they face the stress of what people in the field call unrelenting contact with an ailing relative. Ezra Susser, an epidemiologist in the School of Public Health at Columbia, who has worked with indigent schizophrenics, said, "You have to be really careful not to set up a situation where the family feels that they are being compelled, morally, to do more than they really can do." While family involvement improves the lives of schizophrenics, it does not transform them into who they might have been without the illness. And a family's costs in such attentions must be weighed against the benefits that can be achieved. The World Health Organization recently undertook a vast study to see where the best outcomes were for people with schizophrenia. The best short-term results were in Nigeria and India, where medical treatment is often extremely basic. The reason appears to be the family support structures that are built into those societies. "It was very difficult for me, when I first trained here, to understand how a family could drop off their son or daughter and just leave," said Cyril D'Souza, who is Indian. "If you adjust for everything else, medications, dosages, access to care, socioeconomic status, the ones who are doing well tend to have meaningful family relationships." Whether the kinship structures of developing societies are preferable to Western ones for people in perfect health is debatable, but the division of labor within extended families clearly allows for a higher quality of care for people with mental illnesses. In Senegal, when someone is taken on as an inpatient at a mental hospital, a member of his family usually accompanies him there and stays for as long as he does. Such habits reassure psychotic people that they are permanently knitted into the social fabric. In the West, conversely, families often disenfranchise schizophrenics. Some people with schizophrenia lack insight into their condition and have to be strong-handled. But others are the primary experts on their own condition, and some have offered their families suggestions on how to interact with them. Support groups for families of people with schizophrenia have proliferated in the last 20 years, as the stigma around having produced a mentally ill child has diminished. Esso Leet, founder of the Denver Social Support Group, has schizophrenia and pleads, "Criticize only constructively. Do not write off all conflict as symptomatic of illness. Find a role for us in the family other than being the sick member." One support group website proposes, "Approach delusions in a spirit of shared inquiry. Don't push if the person starts to get upset." While the positive symptoms of schizophrenia are most disturbing and striking to outsiders, the negative symptoms are frequently more burdensome for families coping with a son's or daughter's hostility, absence of personal hygiene, and listlessness. It is hard to remember that these are not flaws of character. The father of one schizophrenic said, "My loving, bright, amusing son was now not just very ill, but had also turned distant, cold, bitter, insultingly rude. It would have been easy to dislike him intensely." 25 years later, The father was still struggling with this problem. How do you keep on loving a son who can be an unpleasant stranger? One mother said, "These kids die, but they never get buried." An activist group called Families of the Mentally Ill Collective, formed by families of schizophrenics in Massachusetts in the early 1980s, stated, "The sick child inhabits a different world, and that world, consciously or unconsciously, terrifies the parents." Schizophrenia cannot be cured with encouragement and love alone, but it can be hugely exacerbated by neglect. Malcolm Tate, a man with severe paranoid schizophrenia, made murderous threats against his family for 16 years while they tried persistently to find him treatment. He was repeatedly hospitalized, repeatedly released too soon, and would not take medication on his own. Finally, in December 1998, his mother and his sister drove him from their home in South Carolina, and his sister shot him to death by the road, then wept. "I was scared that one day Malcolm was going to lose his mind and harm me and my daughter, and I just didn't know what else to do," she said at her trial. She was sentenced to life in prison. Rosemary Baglio's family is riddled with schizophrenia. Her uncle came home from World War II a little touched. He lived with Rosemary's family in Malden, a working-class Irish suburb of Boston, and as a girl, Rosemary loved to go up to his room. On good days, he would put rolls in the player piano and show the kids Irish step dancing. On bad days, he would argue with his hallucinations. When Rosemary was in her late 20s, her brother Johnny became psychotic at age 17. Rosemary told her mother that something was wrong, but her mother refused to hear it. When Johnny started smashing things, Rosemary was the one who took him to Massachusetts General Hospital. "My mother wouldn't let anyone visit him other than the family," Rosemary recalled. "We were never to tell anybody he was mental, so Johnny just completely lost contact with everybody." Rosemary eventually had 9 children. Her third, Joe, was the first boy in her family. He had beautiful auburn hair and soft brown eyes and dimples, and he was just sweet, she said. Everybody loved Joe. In high school, Joe began to have troubles. His parents thought he was getting into drugs. His grades dropped. He stayed up all night. "Finally, when he was 17, I told him, 'Daddy and I are taking you to be examined. We have to find out what is going on.' He was terrified." That very day, he had his first real breakdown. The kitchen had a long pantry with a window at the end of it, and the cabinets were all glass, Rosemary said. "I came home, and it was all smashed, and there was blood all over the kitchen ceiling." Rosemary found him checked into the hospital with a severed artery in his arm. When she got there, Joey said, "I'm sorry, Ma. I'm sorry." When she wept, he reasoned, "It's better I'm here than any of my sisters." He stayed for a month. Rosemary was determined not to repeat her mother's imposed isolation of Johnny. "I was very sad, but he was sick, and that was it. I was upfront about exactly what was going on." Joey finished high school and found a job in a photography store. Then one day, Rosemary got a call that he was running in traffic and screaming incoherently. When he emerged from that hospitalization, Rosemary decided to find him a halfway house, but within a year he was psychotic again. The Tri-City Authority, responsible for mental health services in Malden, insisted that he was not sick enough to be hospitalized because he knew his own name and address. He was living on a barren, rocky slope above Malden. Rosemary wouldn't let him come home because she was afraid he would harm his siblings. Can you sacrifice the other 8 for the one that's sick? He was so gentle underneath that if he ever did hurt somebody, how would he live with that afterwards? I had to protect him, too. To keep contact, she promised to pay for Joe's cigarettes. She gave him enough money for only 1 pack at a time, so he had to come by her house every day. I'd make sure he had something to eat and give him his money, and off he'd go, she said. Her husband, Sal, had been unable to cope with his son's illness. 30 years later, Rosemary insisted that I interview her at her daughter's house because she said her husband would fall apart if he heard her talking about it. Thanksgiving was coming, and it was really cold, Rosemary told me. I said to the court clerk, "You have to get me in to see the judge today." Meanwhile, Rosemary told Joe that he'd have to pick up his cigarette allowance at the courthouse. She pulled him in front of the judge. There were no soles on his sneakers. He was dirty from lying on the ground all night. I said to the judge, "Could you serve Thanksgiving to anybody, knowing your son is living like this?" The judge committed him. After his condition was stabilized, he was released to Sal's octogenarian parents in Somerville, 5 miles away. To maintain good mental health, Joe needed to have daily injections of Prolixin in Malden. He went the first day by bus from Somerville to Malden, Rosemary said. He waited, nobody there. Got on the bus, went back to Somerville. For 3 days he went, but the person was out sick, and nobody told us. Joey never got his shots. The 4th day he started hallucinating. He went in the backyard at Sal's father's, crawling on the ground like an animal. My father-in-law comes out on the back porch. He says, "Joey, you come in and Grandpa will help you." Joey attacked his grandfather so savagely that he had to have brain surgery. If he died, Joey would have been charged with murder. Joey was committed to 1 year at Bridgewater State Hospital for the mentally ill. "Oh, he was sick," Rosemary said. Then they realized his days on insurance had run out. The very next day, he was miraculously cured and he was going to come home. I said, "If any harm comes to anybody because of what you're doing today, I'm taking you to court and I'm going to sue you for every penny this place is worth." Joey was transferred to another hospital, and he eventually got well enough to leave. By this time, he was in his mid-20s. Rosemary was open to having Joe at home again, but if she took him in, he would lose services given only to those with no place to go. She finally installed him in a halfway house with his Uncle Johnny. In his later years, he devoted himself to taking pictures of the other residents, images striking both for the desolation they portray and for the kindness with which they portray it. He also drew, a skill he'd had since childhood. His primary psychiatrist still has a picture Joey drew hanging in her office, an ink sketch of himself. "You have to look really closely," she said when I saw it. "But there's another man in Joe's ear. That's the voices whispering to him." On April 5th, 2007, Johnny choked on a piece of meat and died. 2 days later, Joey was diagnosed with lung cancer. "As soon as he was diagnosed, we moved him right home. Consequences be damned," Rosemary said, weeping. "Every day he had chemo. They found it in his brain, started another kind of chemo. Then it was back in the lung. And he never complained. Joey said to me, 'Ma, it looks like I'm not going to make it.' He says, 'Ma, if I'm fighting, let me fight. But if I'm slipping away, please let me slip away.' That's what happened. He just slipped away right with me sitting there." Johnny and Joe are buried side by side. When I met Sal, Joey had been dead for 6 months, and Sal was a shadow of a man. He was down to 112 pounds, gaunt and sorrowful. Rosemary was overflowing with her story, but Sal's sadness had turned him entirely inward. "Can I make Sal better?" Rosemary asked. "No." "Can I make him want to live?" "No. I've been fighting for Joey for 32 years. I've been protecting him and fighting for him every inch of the way. And I couldn't save him. I couldn't save him." 6 months before Johnny choked, Rosemary had put her parents' house, where she had grown up, into an irrevocable trust. "I did it in case the halfway house didn't keep going, so that if those two were alive and we weren't, they would never be on the street. It's set up now so that if any of my grandchildren develop this, which is likely, they cannot become homeless. We're just waiting to see who's next." Schizophrenic self-advocacy is different from deaf rights or LPA politics or neurodiversity because members of those movements are presumed to have an accurate understanding of themselves. They're often accused of not appreciating mainstream reality. Dwarfs cannot really know what it's like to be tall, and people with autism may not conceive of the pleasures of social intelligence. Their comprehension of their own circumstances, however, is usually sound. The defining quality of schizophrenia is that it entails delusion, which complicates its claims on identity. Are people who gain a sense of coherence from their schizophrenia achieving self-acceptance, or are they in a web of denial that is a symptom of their illness? Schizophrenics' own decisions are complicated by anosognosia, having as a symptom of your illness the belief that you don't have an illness. In the Jacobean play, The Honest Whore, Thomas Dekker writes, "That proves you mad, because you know it not." Schizophrenic self-advocacy raises awkward ontological questions. Is there a self that is more real than a patient's own current experience? A true self that can be teased apart from the symptomatic one? "We should not be in the business of choosing selves," Ellen Sachs has written in her memoir of her schizophrenia. One father said, "I thought my son's getting better would mean that he didn't hear the voices. His getting better only means that he doesn't listen to them as much." I sometimes think that the emphasis on insight among psychotic people is like our focus on contrition among criminals. Self-awareness and remorse imply that aberrant people are more like us than their actions suggest, and that consoles us. But they serve little advantage unless they change behavior. Though intelligence is in general associated with better life outcomes for people with schizophrenia who survive it, schizophrenics with higher IQ are more likely to commit suicide than those with lower IQ. Insight begets lower self-esteem and more depression, even for those who do better at some kinds of self-care. Further, those who are delusional are less likely to commit suicide than those whose delusions have gone away, even though some schizophrenics commit suicide because of command hallucinations. This insight that mainstream society wishes upon people with schizophrenia allows them to act in accordance with what the world expects. But it shouldn't be misconstrued. You have no idea how many people you interact with who are hearing voices but have the insight not to pay attention to them, John Crystal said. I'm in awe of the patients I see, many of whom are functioning incredibly well despite constant hallucinations. Understanding what's going on saves them, but it doesn't make them happy. A recent New Yorker article described Linda Bishop, a woman with psychosis whose hospital record said she was extremely bright and very pleasant and denies completely that she has an illness. She refused to sign any paperwork that said she was mentally ill. The article explains, when psychotic, she saw herself as the heroine in a tale of terrible injustice, a role that gave her confidence and purpose. Linda eventually starved herself to death in an abandoned house, believing she was doing the Lord's will, and apparently at peace inside her own madness, happier, in many ways, than Crystal's wiser patients.